welcome back to another edition of Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job? I am your host, L. Ariel, and we can be found at musicjobspodcast.com. That's musicjobs with an S, podcast.com. So it's after Labor Day. That means that summer vacation is over. It's back to school, back to work. But hey, we got a ton of podcasts coming your way all about, hey, how they got that music job. That's right. We talked to the movers and shakers and innovators all about their career trajectories, all about how they started, how they got to where they are today, what advice or insights do they have about the music industry, about the music business, where is the music business headed? All those questions and more are answered on our podcast episodes. You can either find us on all the streaming platforms, iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Android, and more, or you can actually just go to the website, click on the podcast tabs, and we have all the episodes we've ever posted up on that tab. So little shout out slash shameless plug. We were actually mentioned in Access.com's 7 music related podcasts you should be listening to right now. And we came in at number 2, whoop whoop, right after the Joe Budden podcast. So I feel pretty chuffed about that, if I do say so myself. You can actually read the entire article on the Access website. It's axs.com. Or you can actually link to it from our site, musicjobspodcast.com. So on with the show. Last episode, I had the immense pleasure of speaking with Nautica de la Cruz. She is the radio personality who DJs from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. on the one and only KJLH, the iconic and historic radio station of Los Angeles, owned and operated by the one and only Stevie Wonder. And Nautica has had a heck of an amazing radio career here in Los Angeles, spanning over 2 decades. So she talks about that amazing career trajectory and gives some advice and insight about what it means to be a female DJ in Los Angeles for such big radio stations like Power 106 and for 93.5 KDAY and more. Very happy to introduce my next guest, Lolita Ritmanis. She is an Emmy award-winning composer. She's been nominated for an Emmy 10 times and won for the Warner Brothers series Batman Beyond. Just a very long and illustrious film and TV composing career. She's going to walk us through her career trajectory and what it's like to be a woman film composer in the entertainment business. So very, very interesting. But of course, before we get started, I need to feature one of Lolita's tracks, which is the theme to Justice League. So here we go. So much for joining me on Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job?
Oh, my pleasure.
So I like to start out from the very beginning. If you can share with us just about your first memories of music, what was the household like that you were growing up in terms of exposure to music? What did your parents listen to? That kind of thing.
Sure. Well, I had a very interesting childhood. I am the youngest of 3 kids, and my brother is 13 years older than I am, and my sister is 15 years older than I am. My sister was actually, well, she is an accomplished musician, but she, her early part of her career, she was a concert pianist, and she played, you know, Carnegie Hall and toured and whatnot. So I grew up basically in the house listening to her practice a lot, and my brother was a music fan. He played a little bit of, you know, bass in the orchestra, but as far as music in the house, it was a lot of my sister practicing. My parents were, my father recently passed away, but both parents were very interested in music, but not professional musicians, but they would attend the symphony. And since I was kind of the baby of the family, sometimes they would bring me along when I was a little girl because they maybe didn't want to get a babysitter or whatever. So it was a very nice, it was kind of a nice side effect for me that I was able to go to concerts. And, you know, I wouldn't always stay awake for everything, but it was, I think it was just that constant infusion of the creative arts. So that was definitely my early childhood. And of course the piano lessons that came, you know, first my sister was my teacher and then I studied piano and some other instruments too as I grew up. So that's the short answer.
So you were really immersed in it. And did you enjoy it? Did you enjoy, you know, taking piano lessons? Was it something that you were excited to pursue?
You know, I enjoyed it to a certain degree, but I credit my mother for not stopping the music improvising that I was doing when I was supposed to be practicing Mozart or Bach or Beethoven. She would, she'd be in the kitchen and I'd be at the piano practicing something, and then all of a sudden I would move to whatever I was just kind of making little. I thought of them as like little tunes that I would make up in my own mind, and she didn't stop and say, "Oh, you really need to be practicing this." So those were kind of the early stages of me testing the waters as a composer. Now, I wouldn't necessarily have thought to call myself a composer. I was just making up my own music. So that kind of creativity was very much encouraged. Another facet of my life is that I have also a European citizenship. I am Latvian and American. My parents immigrated to the United States during World War II from Latvia. They were fleeing communism. And so since they had, when Latvia regained its independence in 1990, descendants of Latvian immigrants were able to also apply for EU citizenship. So being Latvian has been a very active, important role in my life. And for anyone that has any, I mean, I don't know how much your listeners know about Latvians and music and the choral tradition, but it's a huge part of my fiber, my existence, as far as just how much music is involved, and how many, you know, folk songs and music, the world of choral music and just music in general is a very big part of Latvians' daily life. So early in my childhood, I was able to also, you know, sing in the Latvian choir and write music for different ensembles and have it performed. And so that was also a really active part of my early childhood.
So you, as a child, you were writing for these chorales?
I started writing stuff that was being performed at about age 11.
Wow.
But then when I went to high school, I kind of always thought I would be more of a singer-songwriter. That was what I was pursuing in high school. I sang in the choir, I played in the orchestra, but I loved being on stage and performing. And so after high school, I grew up in Portland, Oregon. I moved down to Los Angeles to pursue a career more I was going to be the next Carole King or, you know, that, you know, singer-songwriter type of career was what I was interested in. But in the process, I discovered that film music and television music and, you know, composing and arranging and working with larger orchestras and writing to picture, I developed a real love for that. And I also kind of simultaneously was developing a dislike of what it would take to have a successful career as a artist on stage. It's a whole nother thing. I was definitely felt more like I wanted to be the composer and not so much worry about, you know, what clothes I was going to wear and what kind of, you know, that whole idea of being a performing artist is a whole nother career path. So I switched more into the composer role, and I have not really regretted it ever since. Even though I still love singing and performing, being a composer is definitely been a great route for me to choose and pursue.
So. Well, let me ask you about that, because that is quite audacious and brave for you to move to LA just out of high school to be a singer-songwriter. Did you consider going to, you know, a music school, college at all?
I absolutely did. I had, coming from a family with everyone with second, you know, master's degrees, et cetera, I was, my full intention was to go to a traditional university. And I remember we did the whole university trip and looking at all these different schools. And at that time, there was a school called the Dick Grove School of Music. It's no longer in existence. You're able to take some of the courses online, I guess, now. But Dick Grove was a very active composer arranger in Los Angeles. And his school was very much like a trade school. It was only music. And he had the teachers at the school were the working composers, working musicians in town. So I had classes with people like Henry Mancini and Lalo Schifrin, and you know the amazing composers of that era. They were actually they presented classes at the school. So we discovered the school, and that's where I went. That was my formal education, and then I took the requisite music history and traditional harmony and theory courses at CSUN. But the whole purpose of me going to DeGrove School was I really, really wanted kind of to fast track. I didn't think of it as fast track. I just thought of that was the place that addressed my passions. And I was just, it was just like the light bulb went on when we walked into that building and sat in on a few classes. It was just the right fit. I mean, now there are so many choices for aspiring composers interested in media music. I mean, of course, the obvious, you know, everyone thinks mentions USC Thornton School of Music that has a film scoring master's program, and then there's Berkeley in Boston. There's a new film scoring program at Eastman, and there's a really good film scoring program at the Frost School in Miami. Film scoring is kind of becoming not necessarily get a degree in film scoring at every university, but it is something that is very much on the minds of the world of academia, because not all composers want to pursue a career as a composer writing for the concert stage for new music. I love some of the new music, but I understand also that there are composers that just aren't necessarily looking to pursue careers in that area. So the fact that there are these programs available now is really fantastic. And that was not the case when I was looking for that.
Well, we've had a previous guest on talking about DeGrove, so it's definitely a well-known, even though it's no longer, it's definitely sort of a well-known LA music institution. I wanted to know if you could just expand a little bit, because I want to get kind of your mindset of going, first sort of going to LA as the next Carole King and then transitioning into composing, because I think that it's not that usual to do. A lot of people would say, oh, well, I'll just write songs for someone else, some other artist.
Right.
Or, you know, I'll play in a band. I'll just do, you know, or session player. Like, what made you make that transition into composing?
I really think it was just the marriage of how music can affect people's emotions, and that synergy between the visual and the music. I found that I really got a charge out of writing music to picture and having music be able to impact a scene, and just that collaborative process. Coming from having done quite a bit of musical theater in high school, and then even afterwards, I mean, I've myself now written 4 full-length musicals. I love musical theater, so theater, music, how it all fits together, and then also, you know, how also that translates also, some of that translates to film music also, is just the marriage of all the different disciplines to me is very, very interesting, and just that collaborative art form, it just sparks an interest. I mean, I love writing songs. I still write songs. It's not something that I stopped. I do think that the world of the songwriter pitching songs, it's very difficult now, because everybody and their aunt is a songwriter, singer, and an artist seemingly always wants to write songs. There are very few artists that are just looking for songs. I think people want to be in that collaboration and also get a piece of the financial pie. So to be solely a songwriter and not be an artist and not have some other avenue for income is the songwriters that I know, the really successful ones work so amazingly hard at that every single day, writing and pitching, but it's not something that necessarily translates that well into, you know, especially the creative types, I think, that are not artists, that are solely songwriters. The essence of a songwriter, I think, often is somebody who is sometimes he's tormented and is sometimes, you know, not necessarily outgoing, and it's an introspective kind of art form sometimes. So, you know, you get the best song sometimes out of someone that has, would never even consider trying to shop a song kind of thing. So, I mean, but that's a more philosophical, complicated discussion, but I do think it's worth it for your listeners that are interested in pursuing careers as songwriters to think about the fact that, you know, pitching songs and all that, that's like a whole big, it's a business. It's not, it's really, you have to be dedicated and willing to, you know, deal with a lot of rejection and just keep your chin up and keep going if you want to carve out a career in that field. So.
Yeah, absolutely. And I appreciate you talking about that, because I do think there, you know, it has become so commercialized, and attached to that has sort of been this mythical, you too can be a songwriter, and easiness to it, which really doesn't exist in the real world. So I think
it
that's
absolutely
a really good
does
point.
Not exist. I mean, I don't know if you've had Diane Warren on, but she is a such a workhorse. She's still to this day, with her tremendous success, the amount of hours that she spends in her studio, she goes religiously every morning to her studio and she writes songs. I mean, this is somebody that is, you know, probably one of the most successful songwriters in our time, but she is a businesswoman and she is just so dedicated to working on her craft every day and also getting in there and getting songs placed and not taking no for an answer. And so it requires that kind of dedication often, I think. I mean, there are the rare exceptions where, you know, you hear the story of, oh, I just heard this wonderful singer-songwriter at a cafe and I love the song and I happen to be a producer and I hired this person to write songs for my television show. I mean, you hear those stories and those are magical, wonderful stories, but for the most part, it's few and far between that something like that happens. Mm-hmm. It's a matter of just sticking to it, and you know, if you want it badly enough, and if you're talented and you work on your craft and you just stick to your guns, something will happen. It's, you know, there's no real fairness in the industry as far as the most talented people rising to the top. That doesn't necessarily that's not necessarily how it works. But if you're dedicated and you work hard and you just don't give up, chances are something will happen, and you'll have some way of earning a living in some facet of this crazy business that we're all in. So,
No, those are great, great points. So you're at the Dick Grove School and you're learning composing. Did you go out on an internship or how did that sort of evolve?
Well, at the Dick Grove School, I was surrounded by a lot of really marvelous industry professionals that were not just the top composers, but people that were in the trenches working in different aspects of the business. Now, the business has definitely changed from when I started. Mm-hmm. When I started and when I graduated, all the electronic orchestration and the, you know, everybody working in Finale and Sibelius and using sequencers and Pro Tools and Digital Performer, and that did not exist. So it was pretty much people working, you know, music was written on music sketch paper and people sitting at the piano and writing it down. Sometimes people would do improvise and put their cassette recorded on a cassette and then have somebody else take the music down. And so my first jobs were really more in the assistant category to other composers. I did a lot of transcriptions for people. My first job, apart from playing in top 40 bands and playing in for weddings and whatnot, my first that I think was a path to film music in some way, was as a music proofreader, and that came through a teacher of mine that I was studying privately with. That was also kind of through Dick Groves. I had studied with a guitar player named Mundell Lowe, who was actually in charge of the film scoring program, and he recommended that I study privately with the late Mauro Bruno. Long story, but he basically, somebody at Disney said, oh, we have an opening for a music proofreader. And to me, that was almost as exciting as getting nominated for an Emmy Award or something. Uh-huh. It was like, oh my gosh, I have a chance to work at Disney.
Yeah.
So, I worked at Disney for a little bit, but then my main proofreading jobs, eventually I wound up at Warner Brothers I took that job just as seriously as I take my job now, maybe even more seriously in a way, because I was just starting out. I didn't want to take any chances or anything. I was always at my desk ready to do my job at, you know, at half an hour before I was supposed to be there. And it was a great training ground. Music preparation still exists, although a lot, 99.9% of it is all, electronic digital, with music mm-hmm. software. So I would say to your music students that are interested in pursuing a career, finding ways to break in, you know, that is a possible way to at least kind of be in the trenches and be around some of larger projects, whether it's video game music or the larger features. All the music still does have to get prepared in Sibelius or Finale, and the parts prepared for the orchestra. And not all composers have fully fleshed out music sequences. Oftentimes they're very kind of basic, and so the orchestrator and then subsequently the copyist that works with the work that the orchestrator has done, they have to really finesse and orchestrate, even though it's electronic. So, you know, people that are interested in orchestration and copying, I would say get really good in both Finale and Sibelius, because this industry is pretty much split down the middle as far as who's using what. I use Sibelius. I tried Finale, but it was just not for me. I think everybody has their own preference of, you know, how your brain functions and what's easier for you to use. But
yeah, absolutely.
That was my first job, and that led to opportunities to orchestrate, actually. From proofreading, I had a chance to orchestrate and do a little bit of what was known back then as ghostwriting. Now there's not so much ghostwriting, as people are actually writing additional music for the bigger name composers. It's being called, you know, additional music. But back then it was, people didn't really talk about it in that way so much.
If you can just, because I'm curious about the orchestration part, how much mm-hmm. of it tapped into your... Because you said it was ghostwriting, so how much of it kind of tapped into your improvising skills? Were you sort of given a very rough sketch, and then you were expected to sort of fill it in, having at least a very similar sound to the original?
It's across the spectrum as far as what was asked of me back then, and I think it's very similar now as far as how heavy the ball is and how much one has to run with it as mm-hmm. an orchestrator. When I worked for my mentor, the late Shirley Walker, her sketches were complete. It was basically sometimes a four, sometimes a six line sketch where it would, you know, would say woodwinds. But so then, okay, maybe I would decide that this would be, you know, a flute solo and this would be a clarinet solo, but at least the timbres were all, she had already indicated what she wanted. And it was my job to take her sketch and flesh it out into a full score to make that happen. There were a few composers that I worked for that basically gave me a recording, an audio recording. I had to transcribe what they wrote. Sometimes it would be with just a piano sound. Sometimes it would be piano and strings. And then I would transcribe it, give them a sketch back, and then they would, you know, kind of mark it up, you know, just with pencil, saying, okay, this is full orchestra. I want this to be, you know, add some brass here. And then I would take it from there and flesh it out for the full orchestra. And sometimes it would be literally on a TV show or something. It would be, you know, hey, I'm doing these cues and I need someone to write the source music, the music that's playing on the radio, or the, you know, if it's a Christmas show, we do the holiday music, you know, because they didn't necessarily want to have to do that, the other music. So I would have an opportunity to do a little bit of writing on some shows, doing kind of the music that the composer didn't necessarily want to get to, or, you know, it's a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and the more professional you can be, and the better your knowledge is in the particular field that you are trying to work in, whether it's orchestration or also, you know, for music, sometimes musicians, some people are hired to do these mock-ups for big films where the composer has, you know, countless minutes of music to write every day for a big feature, and the producer, of course, wants to hear everything ahead of time. So it takes a long time to, no matter how great our samples are and our music libraries, to make the audio, to make something sound fantastic. So there are definitely jobs nowadays for students that have just completed their studies. If they're really technically savvy and they have a great setup with a lot of great sounds, to work in making these demos for the music previews. That's kind of like before it gets recorded with the live orchestra, just to help the composer flush out these great sounding demos. So that's another thing. I didn't do much of that because that was not yet. I was already writing music when the whole technical revolution came and everyone had to take out second mortgages on their homes and buy all sorts of gear to make great sounding music with out of the box, you know. So
right. So can you talk to us now about how that evolved from writing orchestration to now you're sort of headlining, you're writing the score yourself?
Well, it's been quite a long time. My first screen credit music by me was the same year that my son was born. So that's almost 27 years ago. I have two other composers that I work closely with. We have formed a group called Dynamic Music Partners. Michael McQuistion and Christopher Carter and I, just to kind of spread out the workload of these different television shows and long form projects. All three of us were mentored by Shirley Walker. At a certain point, she kind of kicked us out of the nest, and we were very much competing for the same jobs, and we decided to join forces so that we could go collectively after the same work and also maintain a little bit of a better quality of life as far as not having to, you know, well, here's one person just killing themselves trying to get all the work done, and the other two are kind of waiting for the next job. Mm. We decided to let's just you know, we don't necessarily collaborate. We rarely write together except maybe for a theme or something, but it's just kind of a way to have a team where the producer or director, whoever's working with us, has a chance to meet the actual people that are writing on the particular project. As you know, there are many composers now that have huge teams of composers, orchestrators working for them under, you know, one name. There's one main composer, but, you know, you hear like, oh, this composer has, you know, 20 composers working for him or her. It's more the rule than the exception now where the very sought-after busy composers have huge teams helping just to meet the deadlines because the demands are more and more rigorous, and there's just no way physically that one person can, let's say, score six or seven television shows and do two features at the same time. So there is help required. So
I'm thinking of, like, you know, visual artists that had, mm-hmm. you know, teams of painters, right? It's sort of a similar thing mm-hmm. in that, you know, you have the overall vision, and then it's, you know, we've got to fill in these blanks kind of thing. So mm-hmm. But now you've got the byline. So what types of projects were you first working on?
Well, the first job, like I said, the first credit I had was on Batman the Animated Series.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, and you know, I never realized. I think I realized maybe towards the end of that run, because Shirley Walker was the main composer, but I mean, it was an unheard of opportunity that very few opportunities like that exist for composers now. And I'm definitely trying to pay it forward by mentoring emerging composers and well, we can get into that a little bit more later, but I get this call from a music contractor saying, oh, Shirley Walker is looking to mentor and bring in emerging composers and have them work with her. And I just thought, okay, this is kind of a prank call. but it turned out that that's actually what was happening. And Shirley had basically taken on this big project, and Warner Brothers was, at that time, Doug Frank was in charge of music at Warner Brothers, and he was okay with Shirley overseeing other composers working under her, you know, under her guidance. And she did a lot of the work, but she would farm out, you know, an episode here, an episode there, you know, divide up an episode between a couple of composers, supervise it, mentor, you know, give notes And it was just, she had a team of incredible emerging composers that basically had, we had the benefit of working with her, learning from her and her expertise, getting full credit for writing what we were writing. It wasn't ghostwriting. We got screen credit. We got music cue sheet credit, which, you know, is our main livelihood through our royalty stream through either BMI or ASCAP. Mm-hmm. And she was such an honorable person and an incredible teacher. So that was my first big job as far as a composer. I had bigger jobs as far as orchestration for features. I think I would say my highlight in that world really was working for Michael Kamen, the late Michael Kamen. I had an opportunity to work on several big features with him as a, I did transcriptions and orchestration for Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, and some of the Lethal Weapon films. Also, the late Basil Poledouris. Anyway, I have kind of a long list of wonderful composers that gave me an opportunity to orchestrate for them, and I learned so much in that process, and had an opportunity to be on the scoring stage and be a part of these immensely successful big movies and learn in the process. And then when I had the opportunity to step out of that zone and into the world of just composing, it was a little bit frightening at first because I was kind of a big fish in the orchestrator world, but then I kind of had to make a decision to transition more into like, okay, I'm going to compose. I mean, and now I don't orchestrate for anyone else. I do my own work, and I have, you know, if I need an orchestrator, I have, you know, Larry Wrench, an orchestrator who's a marvelous orchestrator, help me on my orchestration if I don't do it myself. So I'd say Batman the Animated Series is my first big project, and it's, you know, I've definitely been in the world of animation, probably, you know, some would say pigeonholed, but I would say as a grateful composer that's been employed for all these years, it's been a really, really great genre to be a part of, because it's really great dramatic music that I have an opportunity to write. It's mainly the serious, you know, not too many comedies. I mean, I've done a Scooby-Doo here or there, but it's a lot of really kind of epic, you know, storytelling, and it's been a great opportunity for me to work on several animated kind of superhero projects and the odd indie film here or there.
That's fantastic. And yeah, I would agree with you in that there's just sort of this, probably at the time, all these sort of untapped or unrealized opportunities and more freedom that you had working on these animated features. And I was going to ask about being in this world and starting out, was it difficult? Did you find it to be there? It was monopolized by certain composers, or difficult to break into other aspects of film composing? Like, what, if you can kind of describe that world for us?
Well, the world is, and it's still this way, whether you have the best agent in town or whether you don't have an agent, it's all based on your relationships. I think that first and foremost, your relationships with the directors, producers, you know, somebody who might be quote unquote an assistant to someone that you actually develop a good relationship with. And when that person then goes up through the ranks and has an opportunity to do his or her own show, they'll remember you and how wonderful it was to work with you. So I think almost, I would say 99% of everything that I've done, and I would speak also for my partners, that it's all been through past relationships and cultivating those relationships and understanding that what I do as a film composer is not about me and my music. It's about helping realize the vision of the director or the producer, helping tell the story that is their story, bringing something brand new to the equation, and sometimes knowing when to stay out of the way, and making the creative team that you're working with feel comfortable enough with you, there can be that collaboration and that exchange of ideas. And that, you know, as a composer, it's sometimes easy for, I'll just speak for myself, I can get very attached to my music. When I do get really attached to my music, what happens inevitably is I have to change something.
So, right.
So understanding that it's a collaborative art form, and that's something that your listeners are interested in pursuing, just understanding that I think the greatest success, even for the master himself, John Williams, listen to him speak sometimes about the collaboration and about the back and forth. I mean, I don't think that in this era there are as many directors and producers that have the kind of reverence that existed, you know, back, you know, let's say 30 years ago, 30, 40 years ago, where the composer was kind of a mythical being that created magic and they didn't know how it happened. Now, because of technology and because of people not really, I mean, some people don't even read music, which is fine, but everyone can be a film composer. If you have GarageBand, you can, you know, press one key down and you can be a film composer. So we are all competing for the same jobs, and without having some sort of a highbrow attitude of like, oh, those people don't know what they're doing, that will come back to bite anyone that holds on to that kind of feeling, because creative people sometimes it can be a situation where someone really is a visionary and they don't have any kind of formal training and they just happen to have some sort of a way of working with a director or producer that works, and it serves the film or the television show perfectly. And so, you know, you can argue against it, but it's not going to do anyone any good other than just, you know, look back in the mirror and say, how can I become a better version of myself, as opposed to grousing about why someone else is successful and I'm not as successful or something like that. So self-perception and being really honest with oneself is key. And I, you know, I've been around for a while and it's something I struggle with. And I kind of say, I hope to struggle with until they put me under, you know, 6 feet under. It's like, I think once I settle into just thinking, oh, I'm so fantastic and everyone should hire me, I'm the best of, I mean, I think that kind of ego and that kind of the unwillingness to understand that it's always a learning process and we should hopefully always be evolving. Otherwise, it's just a dead end, I think. So,
do you mind indulging our listeners, for those that don't know anything about film composing, just a little bit about the specifics of that collaboration with the producer-director? Do you get a rough cut of the film, the animated show, the TV show, and you're told, okay, we need a big climax here, we need some soft romantic music here? Like, if you could kind of just give us a little brief walkthrough of how that process goes.
Sure. Well, this will be kind of just a very overarching kind of idea of what it is. It definitely changes from project to project. Well, in the world of animation, and I would say the higher profile television shows, I mean, I've been working on mainly Warner Brothers and Marvel projects. What happens is usually the music aspect of the project, you start by either working on some sort of a thematic idea for the main theme, unless it's going to be a song, which is a whole nother category. But that would probably be the first thing, that finding the theme, and that's a long process, usually a back and forth, working with the producers, working with whether it's a network or studio or toy manufacturer, whoever else has to weigh in on the theme and the idea for the show. But let's say that's all done and great. You've got a kick-ass theme and you've set the tone for the show, and let's say it's going to be a big symphonic sound, or it's going to be a rock and roll kind of score with guitars, or, you know, whatever it's going to be, you have the basic idea of what the producers and directors are looking for as far as the idea. And for television, it's usually the producer. The director of animation is generally directing the voices and mm-hmm. directing how the animation is being fulfilled. So you meet with the producer once, and it's usually, you normally do not work from a rough cut. You normally work from a, we hope it's a locked cut, but or at least it's close to locked, and you watch the picture, and it's with the dialogue, but it's without the sound effects. Mm-hmm. And, you ask for some sort of a time code reference in the window so you can see, you know, you can have some way of making note of at what time in the particular picture you're referencing for whatever you're referencing, whether it's like, oh, I want this to feel really scary, or I want this to be sad, or this, oh, this is where the action kicks in, or oh, this was animated poorly, and we really need to draw attention to the fact that in the far left corner is some magic gem that we need to the audience to know that it's going to be an important part of the story development or something. So you need to give a musical sting or emphasis to this. So that all happens at something called a spotting session. A mm-hmm. music spotting session is where the creative team gets together with the composer. Sometimes it's just the producer and the composer. Sometimes there's a music editor present. Sometimes there's several producers. And you take as many notes as you possibly can take. Then generally you have the picture and you sit down and you start writing the music. The music preview process can happen incrementally. Just, you know, every time you have written something, you can, you know, either send a little QuickTime preview of the music married to picture and get input from the producer, or you can, which I prefer, to have an in-person meeting so you know, can work on just kind of trying to read the reaction to see like what is working, what is not working. Then you make your changes. And mm-hmm. then you finalize the music for delivery, which will mean if there is budget for an orchestra, that at that point, then you would orchestrate it for a recording session and record the music, mix it, and deliver it. If there's not a budget for that, then you have to, you know, fully realize it electronically or however you're going to do that to get to the finished product. And when you mix the music, more often than not, it's rare that you deliver only a stereo mix. You generally deliver music stems, so mm-hmm. Which basically you split off maybe the percussion from the, let's say, the orchestra sounds, and then you have the synthy kind of atmospheric sounds on separate stems, and that's really to enable the mixers at the final mix where they put the dialogue and sound effects and music together to have a few more options where if something's taken over a certain sound spectrum, you can have a little bit more control. So yeah. And I didn't even talk about money once, right? So you first have to get the gig and you've got to get the contract and all that. But see, I think it's probably good to focus on the creative aspect of it, but emerging composers, I actually always have to say, make sure that you have have a lawyer or somebody look at your contract. You need to know what's what, because it is a business and this is your livelihood. So
yeah, I'm curious if you would have people, you know, if they were starting out today, what's your take on scoring like a student film, like doing something for, what do they call it? Like crafting credits. Like, what do you think about that as far as starting out?
I think it's fantastic, but here's what I say. If you're going to write something without getting paid to do it, you have to look and see, is this relationship, but first, do you like the project? If it's really not very good at all, and there's nothing that redeeming about it, and you don't like the person that much, and you're not getting paid, then you have to figure out, what are you doing that for? I mean, if you see that there's a really dynamic, interesting person, but maybe the project's not that interesting, but the mm-hmm. person seems like, oh, this person has a trajectory towards success, you know, you might consider working on that project as well. And for students, absolutely, hone your skills on student films, but keep the rights to the music. Keep the music publishing. And this is a huge mistake that a lot of emerging composers make, is that they think, oh, I don't need a music publishing company. They think of it as some sort of printed music or something. They don't even understand that the writer, you as a writer, you generally have, you can think of it as 50% for the composing and 50% for publishing, or 100% and 100%, however, but you mm-hmm. should get a publishing company through your PRO, whether you're ASCAP or BMI or most, you know, CSAC or whatever PRO you are a part of, get a publishing company, because that's something you should not give away. If you're licensing your music for use in a short little student film, you retain the music, you retain full rights, and you might be able to then parlay that music that you've written for this thing for something else, or license it for some other future use where you could actually earn some royalties. So I think it's, you know, I think it's good. I don't think, you know, if a project has a budget, a big budget, I think you should ask for something. You can negotiate things. You don't necessarily have to ask for a big fee for your composition. But if that person has, the producer director really had a desire to have an orchestra, well, they should pay for that. You know, I'd say composing sometimes on spec to develop a relationship early on in your career. Again, I say early on. I wouldn't just continue that on at infinitum, because it's we do need to earn a living. So
yeah, absolutely,
music is worth something. So
yeah, absolutely. Very wise words. Well, last question, because I know we're running out of time. But you are president of the Alliance for Women Film Composers, and I'm wondering if you can just talk about that a little bit. And you brought up being a mentor earlier in our conversation. Mm-hmm. So just to kind of dovetail back into that.
Yeah, well, the Alliance started in 2014. Composer Laura Cartman, Miriam Cutler, and myself, those two brought me into the trio that we are the founding members. And it was originally kind of as a way to show respect for what Shirley Walker had started, and also to amplify the work of women composers, advocate for the inclusion of more women composers at discussions with studios as far as who to hire, and also to educate emerging composers. Because the percentages of women composers that are scoring the top 250 box office top grossing films is ridiculously low. It's something like 2%. And most people, when they're asked to name film composers, can't name more than maybe just a few film composers anyway. And then when they're asked to name women film composers, people's jaws drop. They have no idea. They can't even think of anyone, which is pretty dismal. So we did this as a way to bring awareness and to all the different things that I already discussed. And it has really grown to be a very strong community of it's Alliance for Women Film Composers, so we also have men that join the Alliance, because it's to advocate for the inclusion of a diverse section of voices in this business. It's a really good, I would suggest to all your female film composers to just check out the website, and we have a directory. So basically, if a head of a studio calls me and says, I'm looking to expand my roster to at least include some more women in the audition process, I can actually just send them to our directory. And currently, I think we're close to 400 women film composers that are listed in the directory, which, you know, is a long, long way from what I thought originally. It was like, okay, I could list maybe 5 or 6. So there are tremendously talented women film composers, and it's not about some sort of entitlement. It's about society reflecting in our art what society is. Society is not only white male film composers. We have women film composers. We have people of color that are film composers. Diverse voices, diverse ways of looking at projects and scoring them, and just, it's only about opening the doors to allow for a more diverse viewpoint, to diverse voices that will translate into really some spectacular music being composed for these various projects. So I have been the president really because Laura Cartman moved on to be one of the governors of the Motion Picture Academy. So she's one of the music governors of the Motion Picture Academy, and she's doing tremendous things there. And the other founder, Miriam Cutler, is just knocking it out of the park now with her work in the documentary field, having scored RBG recently and the Gilda Radner documentary. And she's just Dark Money also. So my co-founders are just immensely talented and brilliant composers. And so I will actually be passing the baton to the next president this coming year, since I've been president for over 2 years. And hopefully the next president will bring yet another new infusion of good energy to this cause. So.
Excellent. Excellent. So just in final, how can people find you, hear your music? Do you want to share your website or any social media?
My website is pretty simple. It's just lolitaritmanis.com. That's my website. But you can also reach me through the Alliance for Women Film Composers. I would say this. The first people that generally reach out to me when they reach out, oftentimes people don't have questions. They just kind of want to find an easy way into the business. And I would say, do a lot of homework first. Look at the, all the other organizations and seminars and things to do. And when you do have that opportunity to reach out to, whether it be me or any other working composer, really focus your questions. Make sure you've done your homework already. There's wonderful organizations. Society of Composers and Lyricists have great seminars and workshops. There are books out there. It's just make sure that when you're ready to ask the questions that there's something that actually is something that you think, I mean, so it's like, how can I break into the business? Well, it's a long discussion. So,
well, you know, first listen to this podcast.
Listen to this podcast and just, you know, and go and attend things. Be curious. The curious person is going to go a long way. And the person that feels like they're entitled to just be handed a career, that's not going to happen. So, and you know, very few exceptions. So if you're willing to work hard, be curious, be excited, and be full of life and interested in just this whole industry and this whole art form, you're going to do fine, you know. So just, yeah, if that's my positive spin on things, you know, just enjoy the process and you're going to be fine. So
yeah, that's perfect final thoughts. Well, thank you so much, Lolita. I really appreciate your time today.
All righty. Thank you.
Just another thank you to Lolita for taking the time to be with us today and talk all about her incredible film composing career. And I just wanted to also mention that Lolita, along with Laura Cartman and Miriam Cutler, actually received the BMI Champion Award this past spring for their commitment to supporting fellow women media composers through the Alliance for Women Film Composers. So a hearty congratulations to her. And again, if you want to keep track of all of Lolita's compositions and more, you can just go to her website, lolitaritmanis.com. So this ends another week of Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job? And we are just chugging along. Again, very grateful for all of you to continuing to support us. And we do ask that if you are listening to us on one of those streaming platforms that you can give us a rating, give us some stars, show us some love, give us some feedback, tell us how we're doing. I am your host, L. Ariel, and you can find me and all my music and crazy videos at lariel music.com. That's lariel music.com. I'm also on social media at lariel music, so please follow along and I'll follow you back. Okay, have a wonderful week. Take good care. Keep on chugging, and remember to keep on hustling, pursue that dream, and don't you give up.